A powerful memoir of a family with a transgender child.
There was a lot going on behind the scenes that was worrisome. And that was the transformation, what we had of a very happy toddler into a moody and obsessive child. All the while, a child who told us again and again, as clearly as they could, I am a boy. I'm not a girl.
That's Mimi LeMay. We talk with her about her stunning new memoir, What Will We Become? A Mother, a Son, and a Journey of Transformation. Then we welcome a very special guest to our show, Senator Sherrod Brown. He'll tell us about his new book, a celebration of 8 former progressive senators who sat at the desk he occupies in the Senate. The book is Desk 88. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. As we produce this show on November 20th, people all over the world are observing the Transgender Day of Remembrance. The day honors those who have been murdered as a result of transphobia. We are honoring the day by bringing you the moving interview we did earlier this week with the mother of a transgender child. Mimi LeMay's compelling memoir, What We Will Become, runs on 2 converging tracks. The first is her own story of growing up as a spirited girl who loved learning in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish environment that relegates girls and women to a subordinate role. She had to leave that community to be able to live her authentic self. The next track is that of LeMay's young transgender son, Jacob. Born anatomically female, Jacob knew from the age of 3 that he was a boy. What We May Become tells how his parents came to realize and honor their son's gender identity, allowing him to transition at the age of 4, allowing him to live his authentic self. Mimi LeMay, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This is a beautifully written memoir, What We Will Become. It's really masterfully written. It runs in parallel with your story of growing up in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family, with the story of your son Jacob, who was born as a girl anatomically, who you call M in the book, until he transitions at age 4. Why did you create these 2 strands of the memoir rather than just focusing on Jacob's story?
Well, I felt that both stories could shed light on the other. Each one could shed light on the other one. Primarily that, why did I know before there was a lot of public information for parents what to do when you had a very young transgender child? How did I intuit that this was serious and that I needed to allow him to transition? Some of that came from a sense that he was going through a journey that paralleled one I had gone through in a very gendered society, where I began to lose hope in living an authentic life on my own terms. And I saw that sadness in him and the sense of urgency I got that we needed to do something for my son came from that sense of deja vu. So I felt that those 2 stories needed to be told side by side.
You also say that you realized that there was a price that both of you, both yourself and your son Jacob, would pay to live an authentic life. So we'll start with your story. Tell us about your story of growing up in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family. You were born in Jerusalem. Your father was a noted Iranian Jewish scholar. Talk about both your dad and your mom, and then we'll go from there, because you didn't stay in Jerusalem.
Yes. It was a less than ideal marriage, and there were, as it is with all marriages that don't last, I think there was a lot of complicating, complex background to it. But one of the things that clearly separated my mother and my father for me as a child was religion. My mother was becoming increasingly devout within the Jewish faith. My father was a secular humanist and did not think that we should be following the ancient rules and rituals to a T, the way my mother wanted to live our lives. And when they separated and we moved to Boston, my brother, my mother, and I, that separation also meant that I did not see my father very frequently after that. For a few years, it was a week visit every year. And then after that, it dwindled to an afternoon or two a year. And I grew up believing that one of the things that made my father not a good father for me was the fact that he did not take our religion, our orthodoxy, seriously, and that he would try to separate me from my faith. And so I became suspicious of him. And it brings us back to that theme, I feel, of people interpreting your reality for you in a way that doesn't match with what you actually see.
And so this schism around faith occurred. I think many of our listeners may not know what it means to be ultra-Orthodox. I mean, there are three main sects, I guess, of Judaism.
It's a way of life that incorporates not only all the commandments that are in the actual Hebrew Bible, the Torah, it includes all of the safeguard command, all of the rabbi's injunctions and proscriptions, which brings the level of ritual and law to thousands and thousands of laws and commandments that have to be followed. And this is on a daily basis. So there are prayers to accompany almost every aspect of your life from the moment you get up to the moment you go to sleep, including prayers for after going to the bathroom and, certain hand washing rituals for before eating bread. Those are some examples, but Sabbath rules include thousands of laws. I would say mini laws or auxiliary laws to the original few that were found actually in the Bible. So it is a very strict way of life. And it, in order to maintain that way of life, there is a very strict set of rules about everyone's place in society. And for, as a woman, I felt very strongly that this place in society, and this was absolutely well out in the open in the commentaries and in the rabbi, what the rabbis would say, but it was to serve my husband eventually when I had one, to safeguard the home from outside influences, to maintain a kosher home. But for me to continue to learn on a deep level the way the men were, that was not allowed.
Yes, an extreme patriarchy. You know, there is the prayer that men say in the morning and that women say. Now, this is not just the ultra-Orthodox. This is a traditional Jewish prayer. Tell us those two different prayers and how that really defines what you're talking about here.
So every morning I would thank God for making me according to his will. And someone like my brother would thank God for not making him a woman. And on the face of it, it's quite shocking. I was told that this thanking God for not making someone a woman, a man, a woman, was thanking God for giving men additional commandments to keep, because women were exempt from those commandments which were specifically time-bound, like making a prayer over the new moon, for example, every month. And so having fewer commandments, we missed out. Now, that didn't fly because I looked around me and saw that women in our society were subjugated in many ways, and that clearly in thanking God for not making them women, men were saying, thank you for giving me the elevated position that I have in this in our society.
Now, your mom, this is not something that she was born into. She grew up in a secular humanist household as well. But with her fierce faith and your, as you were growing up, your increasing discomfort with the boundaries, the strict boundaries that were being put on you. Talk about your relationship with your mom. It was not an easy one.
Growing up, I had periods of rebellion, especially in my early high school years, because I was in a very strict school that put more emphasis on rote and on what girls wore, for example, having to cover my knees by several inches with a skirt and long sleeves and no access to movies or you know, wearing makeup was forbidden and all things like that. So in my teenage years, I rebelled against those things, wanting some more freedom. But as I grew older, the discomfort was more along the lines of realizing that this was quite a misogynistic society and being unhappy with that. Mm-hmm. And my mother, who I respected and loved and cherished her intelligence and her unique perspective always on life, she had a PhD, she would tell me that I needed to have patience and realize that I shouldn't be confusing the rightness of Judaism with the opinions of some Jews, including the rabbis that would bother me the worst with what they said. Her advice to me was always to mute myself, to just listen and to have an internal life that was fulfilling despite what my external life was. But that discord, maybe because I'm a child of the late 20th century, maybe because of my personality or my temperament, that just didn't work for me. I was increasingly unhappy. And when I turned to her for assistance, I didn't find it, you know, and I still maintain a great admiration for her. She's very much a part of our lives. But I do wish when I had first begun to question, I would have had support along the lines of, you know, this isn't okay. Let me join you in questioning this. And if this doesn't fit for you, let's find a better fit for you, a better school for you to go to, a better situation where you can thrive.
You know, it's interesting. You, despite your early adolescence rebellion, you decided to go to also a very esteemed but extremely strict ultra-Orthodox seminary in England called Gateshead. Why did you decide to go there? And what does that say about your relationship to your faith as you experienced it there?
I loved learning. I was thrilled, even at the age of 14 and 15, with the wrangling between different commentators and exegetes from thousands of years ago, and how we would scaffold all these opinions until we came to a conclusion. In hindsight, I probably should have gone to law school, even though I'm glad I didn't. But I enjoyed this kind of legalistic wrangling, and I wanted to continue to pursue that. And someone had told me that Gateshead Seminary was a place where the girls were taught that kind of excisive learning style, as the men were in yeshivas. And so I became very excited. And I heard it was the creme de la creme of European Jewry who went there. So I went there for the learning. And some of the learning was fabulous, but it came with something which ended up being quite dangerous, I think, for my spirit, which was a very strong message of women's subjugation in our society.
It does seem kind of contradictory that this would be a school that would allow learning in this way. And when we say learning, we have to make clear to those in our audience who don't know about, you know, the kind of education in these sects. It really does focus on Talmudic commentary and commentary on the Bible, basically, and pretty much to the exclusion or at least the diminution of secular learning.
Absolutely.
So why would they teach girls this kind of Talmudic learning, this kind of study, and then at the end say, you got to lock it in a box and forget all about it and just serve your husband?
It felt like a particular cruelty. I absolutely agree with you. The reason they gave was that after Jews became more settled in the diaspora after World War II, huge Jewish communities in America and in other parts of the world became comfortable and started to grow wealth in their communities and settle in. And they felt the girls had lost that fire for supporting a husband who learned full time. and they wanted to keep that appreciation for learning within the Jewish community because they knew that a wife would need to, you know, work from the home to support a husband or be willing to live with a lower income in order to support a full-time learning Torah husband, right? Mm-hmm. And so their message to us was, you need to understand the depth and the beauty of this learning so that you can go and support your husband when he does it. And you can know what you're doing when you push him out of the house to learn every day. And then you are the one who takes over everything else in your world.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mimi LeMay about her terrific memoir. It's not only a memoir of herself, also a memoir of her son. It's called What We Will Become, A Mother, A Son, and The Journey of Transformation. Yes, The Journey of Transformation. You, upon graduating from this seminary, you were so shocked by that message. You know, now you've learned all this, now you have to devote your life to your husband, that you made a radical decision to break with the ultra-Orthodox community. You got a full scholarship to Boston University. Eventually, you met your husband, a lapsed Catholic. You had first one daughter and then gave birth to another, M. So let's get to M's story. Pretty early on, some problems emerged in her behavior, puzzling behaviors. I wonder if we could start this part off by having you read from page 136. This is dated February 24th, 2013. This is a letter for M's third birthday, a letter to her. Read from that letter.
Mm-hmm. February 24th, 2013. Happy third birthday to the incomparable M. LeMay. We are so proud of you. You are an ardent individualist. You love things with a passion. Your favorite color is gray. Your fervor for Rudolph and all things Christmas keeps the holiday going. You've worn the same doggy sweater for 4 months, day and night. You love scotch tape and sticky notepads. You are kind and empathetic. You insist you are a boy. Your favorite headgear is a propeller beanie, not a tiara. You are a terrific little kid and wonderful sister. Daddy and I hope you always stay true to yourself. So in reading this, I actually wrote this to my son what I knew of as my daughter at the time, but it was also for public consumption because I put it on Facebook. And I can read through the lines that, you know, I picked the things that were most charming and unique about my child, but there was a lot going on behind the scenes that was worrisome. And that was the transformation, what we had of a very happy toddler into a moody and obsessive child, all the while a child who told us again and again, as clearly as they could, I am a boy, I'm not a girl.
Yes, and yet it also took a while for you to almost take that in. It's kind of like what you read, you think you are a boy, that's just dropped into the middle there. Part of the background. When did this kind of signal really begin to separate from the noise for you?
It took us at least 7 or 8 months of our son telling us again and again, I am a boy, along with, you know, a decline in his behavior and his mood. You know, and all these red herrings, all this obsession over different clothes. We were just trying to muddle through this. It felt like a mystery. We didn't know what was going on. We thought, oh, sensory perception disorder. He did have a diagnosis for that. Oh, middle child syndrome. For one brief moment, I entertained the idea that he had a past life, something that I don't really credit most, you know, in my regular life. But we were grasping at straws. But when it really hit was in his third year, right before Christmas break, he was in preschool and his teacher pulled out a drawing for me And it was of some stick figures, some people all, you know, the whole drawing was in thick black marker with clouds everywhere. It was an angry drawing. You can see that. And he had written his given name like they told him to, but then she pointed it to me and she said, and, you know, immediately M crossed it out. And it just hit me then. It, you know, it was hovering right above my conscious mind, but it hit me. This for this kid, this is real. This is reality. The reality is, for whatever reason that I may not understand yet, my child knows that they are a boy. And this has to be taken seriously.
Is that how you put it, though, to yourself, that he knows he's a boy? Or did you at that time say,
this is real for him, that this is, you know, he believes he is a boy. I don't think I comprehended yet that kids could be transgender at a young age. That's something that I hadn't been aware of. So his reality that he's a boy, this is real for him. The stakes are higher now because it's real for him. The fact that it wasn't real for me yet, that took some education. That took some understanding on my part.
Yeah. And so talk about that education, or really, what did you find? What can you tell our listeners about, some people call it gender dysphoria disorder. They treat it like a disorder. Other people say it's gender nonconforming. What did you find about kids this young who have this?
So I'm happy to say it's not considered a disorder anymore. That was a bit of a misnomer, which could be harmful, because I think what parents need to understand about trans kids is that this is a normal variation of the human experience, of the experience of gender, which is, we're increasingly becoming aware that it is on a spectrum. And what a transgender child feels and knows about themselves is that their identity, their deeply felt sense of who they are in respect to gender, will be not aligned with the sex that they were assigned at birth. So my son was assigned female at birth, but his identity as he developed was that of a boy. And mostly what I discovered was that a lot of these kids, what's different than just a stage or play acting is that they are persistent and consistent in their identification. And usually this is accompanied by a sense of urgency from the child that if they are affirmed, if they get support from the beginning, this can not develop into dysphoria. They can be perfectly happy in their identity as a trans kid if they're affirmed. But when they are denied, or when there is a pushback over time, that frequently leads to dysphoria and sadness. The journey is different for every child. Some have more dysphoria, some have more body dysphoria, that sense that their body isn't the way that they want it to be. It's not the body that people typically identify with the gender that they are. And some of them don't have that strong dysphoria. We are very lucky. Jacob doesn't have, right now, he's 9 years old. He has transitioned 5 years ago. He is very steady in his identity as a boy, again, persistent and consistent. And he has less of that body dysphoria than he had when he was younger.
Does that mean then that he's comfortable with having, with being anatomically female, but an identity as a boy? Is that what you're saying?
He is not in day-to-day distress about it. And that is, again, that's his journey. Every child is different. He does very much want to go through the transitions that are available to him when he's older, the medical transitions. So he is very firm about that, but he is not experiencing daily distress, which we are very lucky about.
And how do you differentiate this, say, from, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, girls definitely did not have as much fun as boys. And I really wanted to be a boy when I was a young child. And I was a tomboy and I wouldn't wear dresses. And I can remember kind of looking down, you know, under my pants every day, to waiting for something to grow there that never did. But I certainly don't think I ever thought I was a boy. So Talk about the differences, because I think a lot of people might confuse them.
Yes, and I think that's a fabulous question. And I can also identify with, you know, your experience as well, because I also was a tomboy for a while. I was getting into fights with people. I didn't like to be, you know, typified as girly. But you said something very key. You never believed or identified deeply as who you are as a boy.
Right.
You saw some experiences that you wanted. You probably noted very keenly, the way children do, that we gender things in our society and that some of these genderings are very unfair. That's very different than that deep innate sense. It has nothing to do with the toys or the clothes. It is persistent through time of knowing yourself as a boy or a girl.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Mimi LeMay about her memoir, What We Will Become, A Mother, A Son, and A Journey of Transformation. What about those parents? I think there's a movement these days to raise children without gender. In other words, they don't refer to them by gendered pronouns. You know, they don't dress them in a gendered way. What's your take on that?
I think that that's, you know, parents have a right to do that. I think it's an interesting experiment and one that I think can yield some positive outcomes, that kids, perhaps at least at home, don't feel the kind of gendering that we do in society and the putting people in boxes. But when kids get to about 2, 3, 4 years old, despite the genderless upbringing, they will very likely identify as either a boy, girl, or something other than that, maybe non-binary. What trans kids have taught us is that despite the gender messages that they get from society about expectations of clothing and dress and activities and behavior and speech, that they know who they are at a certain point. And that knowing who you are, that gender identity, I don't think that's going to change the kind of expression messages we're getting at home, gender expression messages, you know, expression of your clothes, your toys, your all that. That isn't necessarily going to affect a child's identity. It might give them more freedom to speak about their identity when the time comes, and the sense that their parents are supportive of that. So in that way, it could be really positive. But kids know who they are at a certain point, and they don't all know right away when they're 2, 3, or 4. Sometimes it's a matter of how deeply they think about the topic, are the messages they're getting. Sometimes they're not as insistent about it when they get messages to the contrary, when they get shut down, unfortunately.
Your husband actually was the first to really consider that M was transgender, at least out loud. Talk about how the two of you worked toward, I'm not sure the word should be allowing, but in a way it is, allowing your son to become Jacob, to transition from being M to Jacob. How the two, you and your husband, worked on that together, because I have to say, you guys sound like you have the most amazing marriage, really wonderful support and communication.
Thank you. And it was key around this topic that we were able to talk to each other and were basically on the same page. I know parents, many parents who don't have that experience, and it doubles the difficulty of going through this with your kid. He had seen a TED talk about transgender kids. I think they were teenagers or approaching teenagehood. We thought at the time, even though we talked about the word transgender and we began to learn about what it meant to be transgender, we still didn't think for quite a while that we needed to give my son the opportunity to actually socially transition, by which I mean a change in name and pronouns and dress and being known as a boy. At the time, the protocol, and when we spoke to therapists, the message we heard is that you could wait. At this age, you could kind of wait a little bit. It was kind of wait and see, you can keep them in this in-between stage. What I came to realize was a form of purgatory, which was, you know, you can be who you want in our house. And then when you leave the house, you have to be M, you have to be our daughter. My son tolerated this for longer than I think he should have. It was not helping his spirit. I could see that he was internalizing shame and anger about this. And so where my husband and I came to together and what we needed each other's support for was, despite the fact that the protocol right now is that we can wait and see, it was called watchful waiting. This is harmful and we can see the harm accruing to our child and we need to give him a chance now. The younger, the better to live fully as the boy he knows himself to be. And if one day he changes his mind, there is no harm in having supported him this young. He has plenty of time to grow into his identity, to know what he wants before any kind of medical intervention happens. So we need to be supporting him right now. And very shortly after our decision to allow him to transition, the protocol shifted. More knowledge was out there, more understanding. Clinicians had spoken to more and more younger and younger children, and they began to realize, and studies had shown, that young transgender children are just as firm and just as aware and just as solidly identifying with who they know they are than someone who is not transgender, than a cisgender kid.
And how did the decision to allow him to transition affect his behavior, his demeanor?
It was remarkable. And this is where I bring faith back in, because to me, if I have ever encountered a miracle in my life, this was it. He came to life. He was happy. He smiled. He giggled. It was like a weight had been lifted off his shoulders. The sun came out. He laughed without restraint. He began to take interest in making friends. He began to take interest in his school studies, even though it was summer at the time. So that was ironic. But he was like, yes, I learned this in school, Mom. I know the alphabet. It was like he suddenly, a light switch flipped on and we had our kid back.
Wow. And so now it's 4 years later. Is there anything you can tell us about what's happened since this book, the story of this book, What We Will Become, ends?
We began to realize that supporting a transgender kid in today's world also means advocating for them. And we joined with several organizations that were trying to get a bill passed in Massachusetts, which is where we live, to protect transgender and non-binary people in public spaces from discrimination. We worked on that for about a year and a half, and then trying to defend the law when it was passed from repeal, worked on conversion therapy ban, which is to stop clinical specialists from deliberately trying to stifle a child's gender identity or sexual orientation in the clinical setting, a very harmful practice. And so we, as a family, we've joined forces with human rights groups, LGBT rights groups, to defend our sons and others' rights and their freedoms and their safety in this country. And that has become a requisite thing, especially in today's political environment, where unfortunately trans and non-binary lives have become politicized, and there is a struggle over accepting and protecting them. And he has continued to be a kid who enjoys school, is engaged in the world, and lively and pretty funny, actually. He has a very keen sense of humor. And we continue to support him, and he knows that, and he sees our advocacy, and I hope he realizes, and I think he does, that we are in his corner, and there are a lot of amazing people who are in his corner.
Well, that is so evident from this book, What We Will Become. I wonder if we could take a couple of minutes. I said it at the beginning of this interview that your book is beautifully written, and it is. It's also impeccably organized. I mean, you are weaving together two completely different strands. Well, not completely different, but two different strands that then converge finally at the end. Talk about the process of constructing this narrative.
So the first thing I did, knowing that I did want to weave them together, was I got out some index cards and I wrote down briefly things that stood out to me as important from my childhood in the context of being Orthodox and leaving that orthodoxy, and things that stood out, vignettes, moments, objects in my memory that stood out from my journey with Jacob. And when I had collected about 16 or 20 of these moments, and I'll give you an example. On one piece of paper, I wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because Jacob was obsessed with that. And I realized that that was connected in some ways to my love of Christmas, but having that kind of like, I never had a chance to experience a real Christmas. So I said, oh, well, maybe there can be a story about my childhood and that, and my hidden guilt of enjoying Christmas music and choral music, and Jacob's obsession with Rudolph. But then I would rearrange them. And I wanted to make sure that each story had its chronology intact, but that it had some way to weave to a parallel story in the other side of the narrative, like the either the mother growing up or the child. And it fit. I mean, it fit so beautifully. And I think that was not a function of my skill necessarily, just the fact that the story did have so many parallel touch points. It had this leitmotif that just ran through everything. And it got to a point where I didn't have to work at that, at those parallel threads. They just seemed to me to be weaving themselves together.
Yes, and I would say that that parallel was living an authentic life and that journey of transformation that you talk about in the subtitle. Mimi LeMay, it's just been a privilege to talk with you about this. This is a terrific story and a terrific book. Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca. It was such a pleasure talking to you today.
Mimi LeMay is an international advocate for transgender youth and the author of the viral essay, A Letter to My Son Jacob, on his fifth birthday. Read an excerpt from her memoir, What We Will Become, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Senator Sherrod Brown. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Since his election to the U.S. Senate in 2006, Ohio's Sherrod Brown has sat on the Senate floor at a desk with a proud history. In his book, Desk 88, he tells a story of eight progressive senators who were there before him. They range from Hugo Black, who helped to lift millions of American workers out of poverty, despite an unsavory beginning in the KKK, to Robert F. Kennedy, whose tour among impoverished families in the South turned him into a champion for poor and working people. Together, the eight portraits and political courage tell a story about the triumphs and failures of the progressive idea over the past century and the lessons we can derive today from their example. Along the way, Senator Brown writes about his own fight in the Senate to create a new progressive era where all Americans can know, as Sherrod Brown says, the dignity of work. Senator Sherrod Brown, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Your title, Desk 88, refers to the desk where you sit in the Senate. And you highlight in this book eight senators who also sat at that desk, progressive figures who have inspired you in your Senate career. Progressive is a kind of inward now, but what does it really mean to be progressive?
Well, thank you for that question. And I you said they inspired me. Sometimes they inspired me. Sometimes they disappointed me, because, you know, all of us have flaws. And some of these progressive senators, took them a while to get on the right path, from my viewpoint. A progressive fundamentally is somebody who challenges private power and fights for everyday people. And I talk in the book about, in Desk 88, about Emerson. Emerson said that history is a battle between the conservatives and the progressives. He used a different word for each. But where the conservatives win more often than not, and progressives lose more often than not, but when progressives win, we win really big, and we have huge impact on our country. Collective bargaining in the 1930s, and labor reform, and minimum wage, and social Social Security in the 1960s, Medicare, the Wilderness Act, immigration reform, civil rights, voting rights, Equal Opportunities Act, Head Start, all of those things have, even though progressives might lose an election after that because of interest groups, the Wall Street or insurance companies or big oil or big tobacco come in and defeat some of these senators or congressmen and women that do this, the long-term benefits of our victories help people regardless of your station in life.
And talk about the notion of good government. I mean, I think we've been brainwashed as a society since Ronald Reagan to think that there's something wrong with government.
Well, that's right. And I mean, the book is, when people say, what's the book about? It's mostly about hope. And it's about pretty much the flip coin of what you said. And that is that progressives believe in the power of government to make people's lives better. Reagan undercut so much of what government stood for, from collective bargaining to a safety net for low-income people that are working every bit as hard as upper-income people and get so much less for it, maybe harder, and get so much less for it. So that's always important to remember when you talk about the role of government.
Yeah, I mean, you quote John Kenneth Galbraith in saying, we have private opulence but public poverty, and I think I have the quote wrong. The idea is that we don't invest in our public goods here, and that's been happening for a very long time.
For a long, I mean, it really is our story, much of our history. Again, the progressive eras of the 30s with Roosevelt and the 60s with Johnson sort of interrupted that that whole view that the government doesn't work and government shouldn't. That, you know, just it's kind of the opposite of what we argue. But something happened to me back several months ago that really put your question in perspective. I was for 2 months was thinking about running for president. I did what we call a Dignity of Work tour. I'd never had the ambition to be president, and so I didn't really. But I looked around because some people were talking about it, all that. And I was in Laconia, New Hampshire, and a woman who was about my age, who had been working in childcare for a number of years, she said to me that she said childcare in our country needs to be a public good. And in most countries in the world, in rich countries, it is. We think about child care, maternal leave and paternal leave for families. My office, people get 12 weeks off after the birth of a child. They can take it. You know, the husband and wife can alternate. They can take it together. They can take it over a period of several months. And we need to think of everything from pensions and child care and sick days and all that. We need to think of that as a public good because it makes the workforce better. It makes it more efficient. It makes it more productive. It makes it more humanitarian. And we'll just be a better country if government recognizes child care as a public good.
Yes, and you mentioned the dignity of work. That was a slogan for your campaign, and it's also a touchstone in this book as well. What does the dignity of work mean for you?
Well, I became acquainted with the term, even though it was older than this, with reading a book about much of Dr. King's public persona, especially in the last 5 or 6 years of his life. He very much integrated, might be the wrong word to use here, but he integrated civil rights and worker rights. He knew that work had dignity. He used that term often. He knew that, he said that work is never, a job is never menial if it pays an adequate wage. He knew that if we celebrate workers, if government looks through the eyes of workers as we legislate in Congress or as agencies make rules, that it would mean lower income people would have more opportunity, would have a more decent standard of living. Wealthy people would pay more of their fair share. So the whole idea of dignity of work, whether you punch a clock or swipe a badge, or whether you're caring for an aging parent or raising kids yourself, or whether you're working for tips, whether you push a wheelchair at an airport, or whether you're the on-air radio person in a radio station, or whether you're working in a bank in a moderate wage job, or preparing food in a high-rise cafeteria, in a cafeteria in a high-rise office building, all work has dignity. And if we honor that, I mean, I think this year, when you think about the elections next year, if, and I know this isn't necessarily a political partisan show, but if Democrats understand the dignity of work and contrast that with President Trump, who pretty much every day of his administration has betrayed workers with his decisions, then the country will sort of right itself and move in a better direction.
Now, can you weigh in on the idea that you can either talk about racial and social justice or talk about economic justice as a progressive? Because I think that's something that often is used to drive a wedge between different groups in the party.
Yeah, it's our fault if we let them drive that wedge. Of course, Republicans, conservatives, right-wingers, the Trump administration are going to try to drive that wedge in the Democratic Party. And I hear even some Democrats, when I thought about running for president, people would say, some people would say you've either got to choose to talk to the progressive base or you've got to talk to workers. And I just refuse to think that way. I mean, I win in a state that Trump won by 8 points. I never compromise on issues of justice, on civil rights, on women's rights, on gay rights. I've been for marriage equality 20 years. I've got a lifetime F from the NRA. I'm 100% pro-choice. I always will be all those things. But you talk to workers and you don't, when I say dignity of work, I'm not talking about white male. I'm not talking only about white male union firefighters. I'm talking about union members who, I just was on the phone with some people from Unite Here. That's the union that represents food service workers in the airline industry and hotel workers in Las Vegas, and generally people that, because they have a union, they make a lot more than they would otherwise, but they're still hanging on to the middle class barely because of a strong union. But those are the workers you talk to, you advocate for, you talk about, workers across the board. And so there, many of them are women, many of them are people of color. It's lifting up all workers, and that's what the dignity of work means. And you run with that message as a progressive Democrat. I know some people don't vote for me because I have an F from the NRA, and some people don't vote for me because I'm pro-choice, or don't vote for me because I've supported gay rights for my more or less my whole career. But I also know that enough will that you win elections, even in a state as conservative as Ohio now.
Yeah, hear, hear on that. And I think a lot of people have pointed out that vast majorities of Americans are actually for the progressive agenda.
Absolutely. But most of America is for a progressive agenda, but not if we play defense and not if we try to shade the differences. I mean, in the end, elections are about contrast. That's why when I talk about workers, I talk about Donald Trump betraying workers in the Midwest and our allies in the Middle East. And you don't shy away from justice issues, again, civil rights and worker rights and women's rights and gay rights, but you need to be aggressive in a populist tone about supporting all workers and all people. And, this phony populism out of the White House where, populism, frankly, is never racist. It's never anti-Semitic. It never attacks people who are moderate and low income. It doesn't divide people. And populism doesn't give tax cuts to rich people. I mean, it's clear that populism lifts people up and gives people that don't have as much opportunity as I did growing up, gives them a chance in life.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown about his terrific new book, Desk 88. It's interesting because I think what you're talking about also is something you talk about in this book, Senator Brown, in Desk 88. You say that progressivism is at its best when it appeals to a sense of community. I think that's what Bernie Sanders means when he says, not me, us. And when you're talking about, it's not an either or of identity, of giving justice to some people and not to others. But, a lot of people do think that if others get what they need, it's, quote, I've heard this over and over again, it's getting something for free. So how do you connect the dots for voters between the individual benefit and the social benefit?
Well, you said it really well, and it's important that we all do better if everybody does better. I mean, these divisions in our country now, the huge gaps in wealth, so many people have lost the opportunity to join the middle class because of this huge gap in wealth, and we need to make that front and center as we talk about government, talk about politics, and we recoil from it as progressives sometimes and as Democrats. People want to feel good about their country. They want to feel good about others in their country. And we can't let politicians divide us on race or divide us on class warfare when so many Republicans, you know, accuse Democrats that want to raise taxes on the rich of class warfare. We can't recoil from those fights.
Yeah, you know, I think of LBJ saying something, and I'm totally paraphrasing here. If you hear a man who's telling you to, you know, go after somebody who's lower than you are, beware, because he's got his hand in your pocket.
I've never heard that, but I like that. And that's LBJ said a lot of things. That was better than some. I like that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so in this book, in Desk 88, you talk about 8 senators who sat at the desk that you sit at. Some are very well known, like Hugo Black and Al Gore Sr., William Proxmire, Robert Kennedy, George McGovern. Others not so well known, like T.H. Green and Glenn Taylor and Herbert Lehman. We can't ask about all of them because we don't have time, but I wonder if you could give us some examples of the lessons that you learned from some of them.
Well, I'll start with Hugo Black started off as a member of the KKK. He ran for office in 1926 in Alabama. He won. He renounced his Klan membership after the election, but continued for about a term to vote too often with what the Klan supporters wanted. He said later that he would have joined any group that got him votes. And I wrote about, you know, opportunism, particularly among young people trying to get ahead, particularly among young men, that sometimes they jettison what the right thing is because of opportunity, because of ambition. And that lesson was learned for me. I mean, I think I kind of knew it already, but Black is a good example. But 30 years after Black was elected to the Senate, he was, as a member of the Supreme Court, he was a major player in Brown v. Board of Education, the most important civil rights case up to that time, I believe, in American history, the most important positive case, Supreme Court case. And he was burned in effigy at his law school in Tuscaloosa because he so strongly opposed segregation. So he became something very positive. Bobby Kennedy started out as a lawyer for Joe McCarthy's committee, later as attorney general for his brother's administration, wiretapped Dr. King. But the last 3 or 4 years of his life is what we celebrate. And Bobby Kennedy had, in Marion Wright Edelman's words, and I, my wife and I had dinner with her a few years ago talking about Kennedy, and she said he had an uncommon empathy that she had never seen in any other senator and in very few human beings. So people evolve, they change. It doesn't excuse their previous life. And it's important to make, if you can ever make up for that, particularly Klan membership. But, you know, you look at what some of these people did. And I would also say one other thing that I think is relevant to this, Ms. Rhiannon, is that these people that sat at this desk, the 8 senators I wrote about, all were white men. And the entire Senate was almost all white men, with the exception of Margaret Chase Smith in many of those years. And If I were to write this book 50 years from now, I won't likely be alive, but if someone were to write this book of Desk 88, they would celebrate women and people of color sitting at this desk who made the Senate more progressive. And I will always believe that a more diverse Senate, a Senate that looks more like the United States as a whole, will be a better Senate, a more progressive Senate, and govern our country better.
One thing that you clearly call out in this book is the corporate class, and that's one that's both Democratic and Republican. And right now, it seems that the Democratic Party, is struggling between two visions. One that says we make change more by incremental means. The other says we need broad, structural, fundamental change. And I just wonder, where do you stand on that? Is there a path forward with incrementalism that can lead to deep structural change, or does it depend on the moment that we're in?
It's all of that, but I would answer this way. In a couple of book talks, people said if you were writing about another senator, if you could choose, who would it be? And I said Humphrey. And I said Humphrey for two reasons. One is Hubert Humphrey was, they call him the happy warrior. He brought a joy to his job that made people want to move forward in a progressive way. And Humphrey, I mean, he obviously was, his career was, reputation was undermined by his support for Johnson in the war. And I totally see that. But when he was in the Senate, the kind of things he did were phenomenal. But the other thing about Humphrey is he worked what would call an inside-outside strategy. He worked with people outside the institution to put pressure on Congress. And whoever the president is, if it's somebody that we think of as the progressive, you know, I don't like wings of the party. I don't know that that's very accurate. But if the two or three candidates that are the most progressive, or those who believe more in incremental change, whoever's elected, it's important that they understand and Democrats understand how important it is to get the public engaged. Because I think in 2020, we can elect a president and win the Senate and launch the third, fourth, depending on how you want to define it, progressive era, the first one in some time. And we can do things like address climate change in a more than incremental way. And we can make childcare a public good. And we can do real infrastructure with all the clean energy elements as part of it. We can do a lot of these things. But it also takes social movements. And that's what's good about a number of these candidates that are really appealing on progressive causes to people to push the White House. I remember FDR would often say, okay, to a group of liberals, they called them mostly in those days, would come see him and he'd meet with them and he'd say, I agree with you. Now go make me do it. And, you know, whether it's some politicians are going to need to be made to do it more than others, but it really is up to the social movements and the grassroots in our country, partly for the president, but partly for a Senate and House, because we're going to have I do think we're going to win the Senate, and we're going to have a progressive Senate, but not everybody's as progressive as I am in the Senate, and even the Democrats aren't. So it's important that there be the public pressure and the Hubert Humphrey inside-outside strategy that has brought us the progressivism in the 60s and really the 30s also.
Well, that's terrific. And there is so much more in this book. I mean, you tell not only the stories of these eight senators, Senator Brown, but also it's chock full of wonderful stories that you tell from your own career in the Senate. And it's a terrific read.
Well, thank you. And I before closing, I had two real quick things. One is a lot in there about my mother. My mom grew up in a little town in Georgia, 500 people, called Mansfield, Georgia. And my dad grew up in Mansfield, Ohio. They met at the Mayflower, same name, met in the Mayflower Hotel when my dad was back from the war. And my mom taught me so much about justice, and race was so important to her. And it really made me the progressive I am. And one more thing, that chapter is I do chapters of each of the eight senators, and after each chapter, I write sort of personal reflections about that era or those senators or about justice. And the one that I most enjoyed writing was the one about my mom growing up. My mom, like Hugo Black, the Alabama senator, was a child of the segregated South. She first saw segregation, perplexing, then confounding, then repugnant, and it really shaped how she thought. The other is a hero in this book about whom I only devote a couple paragraphs, and that is a woman named Hattie Canty, who grew up was a sharecropper's kid in Alabama, moved to Las Vegas, worked as a maid in a hotel, and became one of the most courageous union leaders in the country. She personally organized and ran a six-year, the longest successful strike in American history against the Frontier Hotel, which was one of the few non-union hotels in Vegas. She forced that company to eventually give up, sell the hotel, and then they unionized it. And she was responsible for raising the wages of thousands of workers, really, ultimately. She ran that strike without anybody crossing the picket line. So those are some heroes that come out of this book that are not just the white men that sat at Desk 88.
Yeah, and that I think that underscores your last point that you made, that it really is an inside-outside strategy. I don't think you would have had any of those that kind of progressive legislation that you outline in the book without the movements that...
No question. I mean, it's not just senators or congressmen working in isolation. It's got to be the political pressure that shows like this bring to us, and people in the streets and people in their local governments and all of that in their union halls and church basements. So thank you for having me on. I very much enjoyed the conversation.
Senator Sherrod Brown. His book, Desk 88, is a great read, and the prologue alone should be required reading for every voter in America. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with historian David Silverman about his book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Please make sure to like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.